Ladies and gentlemen, acid capitalists, what is acid capitalism? Acid capitalism is a reference to, I'm quoting Jim Morrison, what have we done to our fair lady, our fair sister? We've ravaged and we've plundered her. What has the world of elite economics done to the world today, the world that is for the younger folk to come through? They're thinking about Marxism. They're thinking of a permanent plateau because we've made such a mess of it. I've got to take acid just to get away from the horrors. This is a channel for intelligent discourse. I don't care if you're a rock star, porn star, superstar, we got to follow the money. And today, heavens, today we're in for a treat because I've got Steve, Professor Steve Hank, Applied Economics, Johns Hopkins University. Steve is the boss on the campus. And what's more, what he doesn't know about money and monetary policy, you don't want to know. So, Steve, what a great, great. Did I pronounce your name properly? Hank or Hanky?
No, forgive me. Hanky, Long E.
Hanky, like the Francais. Steve Hanky. So, Steve, a delight to have you on, my distinguished new friend.
Great to be with you, Hugh. Your reputation preceded you. It's great to see you.
Well, they do say in Hollywood, never work with kids, animals, pets, and the acid capitalist. So you have been warned. but for those in the cheap seats, and again, forgive me, but this is a campaign. We want smart money. Money has become dumb and we're suffering the consequences. And my campaign requires a firewall. So we have 30 minutes of discourse for those of you in the cheap seats. We offer Patreon services. For the price of a coffee, you can get more intelligent. I leave that to you, but I will come back in 30 minutes to bid you adieu. Steve, now I want to call you Stevie Hanky, but now I'm getting very confused. What's going on? Give me your lowdown on the world. What's going on? So I've got my views, and let's see where our worlds collide. So, yeah, there's been big prints in inflation worldwide. If we take a few steps back, we had an alien body invasion that gave us a pandemic. We had an antibody which gave us a recovery. We had an economic intervention to keep the good folk idle but remunerated. And then we've had the mother of all economic recoveries in the United States. And finally, we've had the Federal Reserve in a manner which is unprecedented. It has increased interest rates at a magnitude and a rapidity that they've never done before. And even before the economic storm clouds arrive on shore, we have lost three American substantial banks and assets. And of course, we've seen the demise in another fiefdom of Credit Suisse. So that's the past. Steve, what is today? What's it all about?
Well, you mentioned here the importance of money, and it is all about money. The big problem that's facing us is that the central banks, starting with the Federal Reserve in the United States, and of course the Bank of England just copies whatever the Fed does, more or less, and so does the ECB in the Eurozone. and they have basically canceled the quantity theory of money. They don't pay any attention to the money supply. They don't realize that it's all about money. If you change the rate of growth in the money supply substantially, it ripples through the economy, the effect with lags. So we had in 2020 with COVID a huge increase in the money supply in the United States. It actually was peaking out. If you go back early in 2020, we were up at actually February of 2021. Here I'm looking at a table here. It was about 27% year on year. Now, to hit the inflation target, the growth rate in the money supply in the United States would have to be about 6% roughly. So you can see it was soaring over three times higher than the gold, what I call the golden growth rate, the 6%. So we got a lot of inflation. We anticipated that. John Greenwood and I did forecast that inflation would get up to 6%, maybe as high as 9%. Got up to 9.1% in the United States. And then the Fed, again, not watching the money supply, has thrown the car into reverse. And now the money supply is contracting on a year-over-year basis at about 4% per year, contracting. We haven't seen that since 1938. So as a result of this, of course, the inflation rate has been collapsing. But the Fed isn't watching this. Now, this gets back to kind of what your intro was, Hugh. Stability might not be everything, but everything is nothing without stability. And we have had a tremendous unstable growth in the money supply. And as a result of that, we get these wild ups and downs in economic activity, asset prices, and inflation. So that's kind of the background. The big mistake is that the central banks are not paying any attention to the money supply. You mentioned interest rates. They're paying attention to interest rates, but as Milton Friedman told us a long time ago, monetary policy is not about interest rates. It's about changes in the money supply. So that's kind of the intro. You want stability. Again, stability might not be everything, but everything's nothing without stability. And the stable growth rate in the U.S. for the money supply, by the way, the golden growth rate that would allow them to hit their inflation target of about 2%, is about 6% growth in the money supply measured by M2.
What I want to put to you is, I hear that, okay, and I have differing levels of sympathy with that. And I certainly agree that steady state, a money supply growth in the order of 6%, which would approximate, if you will, a kind of long-term target for nominal US GDP growth, seems sensible. Okay. However, I feel that the quantitative measurement of the money supply failed many decades ago at the start of the 1980s. I can't say that with certainty, but I can offer a reason for why I believe it lost its potency. And I believe that reason is that there was a revolution in money coming out of Bretton Woods and a refinement of Bretton Woods. We really saw the establishment in the late 1950s of the Eurodollar system. So the creation, if you will, I call it the non-sovereign dollar printing, which occurs offshore between private banks. And I want to say that as a source of money supply, I believe it now is substantially greater than the money printing which we see onshore when banks make loans to their American customers. Have you considered, do you do work on that offshore matrix of money printing?
Well, the answer is I'm fully aware of it, but back to the 1980s, the real problem with the 1980s, shall we say, you know, 79, of course, was when Volcker became chairman of the Fed, and Volcker had the right idea. He was looking at the quantity theory of money. He did want to slow the money supply down because he knew that would slow down inflation. And that's what he was trying to do. The problem was actually a measurement problem in the money supply. The standard, what we now have, the standard simple sum, what they call simple sum measures for the money supply, like M2, what you read in the paper and so forth. That's one thing. And all the components that are in the money supply have no particular weight. They're just all added in a simple sum together to get the total amount of M1, M2. We don't have M3 anymore in the United States, but we actually had it back in the early 1980s. So Volcker was squeezing and tightening up, and the money supply started dropping, but he was looking at simple sum measures instead of what they call here divisia measures. And the divisia measures for the money supply have weights on the various components of the money supply. So some things, for example, and broad money being measured by inclusion of things like money market funds at the time. Money market funds, as you recall, were paying you about 15% or something like that. Well, that component of the money supply didn't have very much moneyness in it because you were getting paid such a high interest rate that you would refrain from converting those money market dollars into real dollars you could use in transactions. You kept your money in the money market. So as a result of that, the divisia measures of the money supply and the simple sum measures diverged tremendously then. And the Fed and Volcker were looking at regular simple sum numbers. They weren't looking at divisia, even though the research department, by the way, had these numbers. They kept the stuff locked up and it wasn't being made available.
Ooh, the screen has gone whizzy, whizzy, whizzy because we jumped from one platform, which was just failing to deliver. There was a Wi-Fi issue at one end, and we're now on Zoom. So there's a degradation. This is not, it's not high definition video, whatever. It's just plain old Zoom. But I think there's a lot of high definition in the rhetoric and in what we're discussing. Bear with us. Thank you again, everyone. And of course, if you've enjoyed the show, please tell your friends, please rate it, comments. Comments on YouTube just become so knocky, but you know, I guess that's just comes with charging. But just wait till I release the acid capitalist fragrance. I mean, we need acid cap. We need this cream is where is Dole?
Duration, smoothness, and the visible reduction in coarse wrinkles.
It's Dole. Anyway, I'm not being sponsored by Josie, but she is one of my best buddies, and I'm in her studio. Has power. There you go. Bye bye.
Okay, a lot of people concluded, Hugh, that quantitative easing that the Fed engaged in was going to create a huge amount of inflation. Remember that they were going on and on about the huge expansion, doubling of the size of the Fed's balance sheet at the time. Well, actually, if all they were doing is compensating for the contraction that was occurring in the commercial bank credit at the time. So if you look, now we're getting down to the money supply. If you looked at what was going on in the money supply, and your question, well, why didn't inflation come up? Why didn't inflation? Because the money supply in aggregate was not growing very fast. It was growing below the golden growth rate of 6%. It was growing about 4.5%, 5% throughout all that period. And that's why we had such a slow recovery from the 2008 fiasco that had been occurring. Point number one, bank credit goes down. That contributes
a negative number to the growth rate in the money supply. To offset that negative, the Fed does quantitative easing. And that's they didn't even fully offset it, by the way, because if you look at the aggregate numbers, the money supply never got – it took a long time before it got up to the golden growth rate of 6%. And so that's kind of a long way to answer your question of why inflation didn't really flare up. Inflation never flared up after 2008 anyplace because the money supply growth was not that great.
Yeah. So can we take a little step back for the folks watching, because banking is not complex. It is complex. When you're opening it up, it's quite simple. The quantitative easing and the magnitude and the exuberance that they pursue in the midst of the turmoil of COVID, you have private sector agents, and they are selling securities via the banks in the middle, but the Fed's agents, but they're selling paper securities to the Federal Reserve. And what happens is for their commercial bank, the commercial bank is then receives an asset, which is a reserve from the Fed. And on the other side of its balance sheet, of course, it receives the deposit from the cash coming in from the sale of the security. And so the bank's balance sheet rises, if you will, by equal measure. It rises by the new deposit created from the sale of the financial security, and it rises on – that's a liability to the bank. And on the asset side, it gets a reserve, a credit from the Federal Reserve. You agree with that? Yeah. Just so we break
this. Yes. Now, point number one, that of course, I know you studied accounting and finance when you were a young man. The key thing is, remember the Nobel laureate, Sir John Hicks, once said, "There's nothing more important than a balance sheet." So that's the point of this lesson. If people don't understand balance sheets, that's all we're talking about. They're going to be completely lost. And most people can't understand a balance sheet. So they're lost all the time. What you said is exactly right. And the point is in the COVID, that liability you talked about that the banks had, the deposits, that was going up. So it wasn't like 2008. We had quantitative easing in the COVID period, and we also had banks creating credit and increasing the deposits that they had, their liabilities, and that's part of the money supply. So the money supply boomed.
Okay, but that hold on. Okay, part one, part two. Okay. So we just discussed, like, as you quoted Hicks, and it's all about the balance sheet. We've brought in a quantitative easing transaction. The private sector has sold financial securities. The liability of the bank has gone up, the deposits, and in return it's received an asset, which is a reserve accounting identity from the Federal Reserve. Now, at that point, I want to say no money has been created. There is latent money. The credit, the transmission occurs when the bank, which has risk-seeking propensities, not all of the time, but let's assume it has a risk-seeking propensity, and it makes a loan to a new customer. And so the loan, of course, is deposited. And so that's the liability. But on the asset side, it has an IOU from a corporation in America to repay over 10 years. Okay, so again, we have another balance sheet identity. Our balance sheet has gone up, assets, liabilities, but now we've printed money. And this is when I get confused with your analysis, because without the transmission, without the credit, without the risk-seeking propensities of the banks, and as you tell us correctly, the government coming in and allowing Lehman Brothers to fail, and then the regulation that was imposed discouraged the risk seeking or the credit transmission from the banks. And so I want to say we had 10 almost 15 years of persistent where the inflation was below target. Now, my point to you is, what changed? I know that we had the Hicksian increase in the balance sheet of the American financial system, but I didn't see risk-taking, renewed risk appetite from the banks. And so I didn't see the credit transmission, which ultimately, of course, must have left us with these higher prices.
Okay. Now, this gets a little bit into the, it gets a lot into the increased severity of the regulation on the banks that followed the Lehman crisis and the 2008 crisis. This was going on big time, by the way, in Great Britain. Remember, Brown was running all over the world, and he even had underlined in his book, I think, something like recapitalize the banks. That was a big mantra of Brown. He was running all over the place. And then you had Basel III, you had Dodd-Frank and so forth. Now, increasing the capital asset ratio, that gets to the heart of the thing. Now, how can you increase if you say banks sometimes have a propensity to take risks? Sometimes it's just the opposite. They have a propensity to avoid risk. So in this case, with the increased bank regulations and the idea of increasing the capital asset ratio, how can you increase a capital asset ratio? Well, you can do it one of two ways. You can increase the capital that you have covering your assets, but that means you're going to have to issue new shares at the bank. And that means you're going to dilute the existing shareholders. Now, existing shareholders, you don't like that. They don't like to be diluted. So that was an option that the banks didn't avail themselves to. So the other way, in other words, you increasing the capital, the numerator, is one way to increase the ratio. The other way is to reduce the denominator, the assets that you have. So you don't roll over the loans and you don't extend credit. You're not anxious to take risk, you see. So that's why this thing slowed down so much. And the key thing many people don't understand, even now, 2008 was a critical thing to understand money and banking, actually. It was the most important time, really. And what most people don't understand is this capital asset ratio thing that kept the money supply growth kind of underwater. It was, in other words, people talk about monetary policy. They only talk about the central banks and what the central banks are doing with interest rates. Well, even that's wrong. If they're going to look at the central banks, they should at least look at the money supply and forget the interest rates. But the other thing is, bank regulations sometimes change dramatically. And when they change dramatically, it can have tremendous impacts on the banks' risk appetites and what the banks do. And this increased regulation and increased recapitalization, increasing that capital asset ratio, that was a key thing, a big institutional change and a big change in monetary policy, you see, because banks produce most of the money. And all of a sudden, you had all these regulations, international, national, and politicians like Brown spooking everybody. And that increased capital asset ratio is the key to understanding the whole thing.
It nullified quantitative easing. Again, if I may put to you, my suggestion is quantitative easing, the Federal Reserve purchasing a security and therefore the transaction hitting the banking sector, you have higher deposits and you have higher reserves held with the central bank. And reserves essentially represent latent money. It's a resource, it's an asset for the bank to extend credit. But you require the bank to be risk-seeking. And if you're imposing regulation, which takes the risk-seeking away, then it nullifies the procedure, the mechanism of quantitative.
Right. As you would put it, it nullifies their firepower. So that's exactly what was going on.
But then help me, because I am not aware of a loosening in federal regulation of the banking sector that would have, if you will, been the spark which would have made this latent quantitative easing money into real money. That's the part of the equation I still miss from the.
Okay. Now, we've covered 2008. Okay, let's move to the COVID thing. That's what you're asking. Now you're asking, well, in COVID we had quantitative easing. Okay, that's one thing. And why did we have that? We had that because the government deficits were exploding and the central banks were monetizing that debt. They were buying the treasuries and gilts that were being used to finance the increasing deficit. So you had quantitative easing, and the monetary base produced by the central banks was going up. But you also had the banks had an appetite. Now you're saying, what clicked with the banks? And what clicked with the banks is that everybody had a credit line. All these corporations had big credit lines. And once COVID hit, what did they do, Hugh? They got panicked because they said, God, they're shutting down the economy. We don't know. We need cash. We want to tap those credit lines and get cash. So when they did that, they did tap the credit lines. And there was a demand for credit, in short, and the banks loaned and extended the credit. And where did that money go? It was going into the deposits the corporations had at the banks. And those deposits count as part of the money supply.
They do. But it's the loan creation, which, as you said, the Federal Reserve does not print money. It is the private banking sector through the mechanism of making and extending new credits to the American corporation or the American citizen. So you described a situation where a Johnson & Johnson, of course, has a huge credit line because it's deemed to be a risk-free company. And it says, heavens, this feels like 2008. And the key for our treasury management is to be as solvent as possible. So they call the treasury line down and they raise a lot of money, but they don't then go out and spend it. That's, again, where I'm missing the leap.
Well, no, but this gets into they don't spend it immediately. They have a tremendous amount of liquidity that they do start spending, by the way. And in the meantime, just from a definitional point of view, those deposits that they have, that counts as part of the money supply. Those liabilities at the private commercial banks, those count as part of the money supply. So the money supply goes up because they have tapped those lines of credit and their deposits go up. So the money supply, technically, if you watch the numbers, it goes up. Now, this gets to an important part, and that is there's a lag between the time that the change occurs in the money supply and the time that gets transmitted through to changes in asset prices. That takes about 6 to 8 months. And then you've got about 9 to 18 month lag before the money gets in and hits the real economy and starts real GDP going. And then you've got another even longer lag of about 12 to 24 months before the consumer price index starts changing and prices start changing. So not only looking at the balance sheets, which you've got that thing nailed down, but then you've got to think about what are the lags between the changes in the balance sheet at the commercial banks, the liabilities, the deposits, the money. What is the lag between that increasing and actually changes in real economic activity, changes in inflation, and so forth?
Yeah, so the money, it went from inert to being in play. Now, if we examine the financial, the monetary data of this century, you know, 22, 23 years. If you were coming at it fresh without the prejudice and the knowledge of policy errors and stock market crashes, you would wonder why there is so much controversy. And this is a controversial statement. But I want to say to you that since the year 2000, you've had a 7% compound annual growth rate in American M2.
Hi, this is a fake voice generated with AI. Those of you who are not patrons, your ride is over. To see the rest of this video, join the tribe and subscribe at patreon.com/youhendry. Patrons, brace yourself and please keep your hands and feet in the vehicle at all times. Thank you, and now back to our normal programming.